What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Welcome to the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Thank you. I am so happy to be here today. How are you?
Doing well. Looking forward to counting down more songs. This is the penultimate, right? I'm saying this correct because we have one more episode before we complete 1984.
This is the penultimate episode, exactly as you said, of our countdown of the top 106.7 songs, K-Rock in 1984. So this is number 20 to number 11.
Then we are looking at each and every one of them, going through them and just having a great time. And this week we've got a special guest, as always, a special guest for Holly because it's a good friend. And please tell us who is stepping into our virtual studios this week.
I feel like we should have our applause sound effects, but we welcome back Dan McGrath, who is just as passionate about this kind of music as we are. And Dan has done quite a few things over the course of his life in the music and radio industry, which is how I know him and how we became friends. Our listeners may know him most notably. He co-wrote the theme song to the TV show Dancing with the Stars, or Strictly Come Dancing, in the UK. We are so happy to have Dan back on the podcast. He's a fun guest. He always has great stories and knows a lot about the music. So welcome back, Dan.
Ricky Gervais said, I used to be the only one with a podcast, and I'm the only one without a podcast.
Yeah. Ready to talk rock and roll?
Yeah.
Well, then, okay, so then let's start talking music. We're gonna do songs 20 to 11. This is, Dan has requested these songs. We gave him the, we showed the 106.7 songs. He's like, this is my chunk. I want these songs. This is it.
Okay, wait, first of all, welcome, Dan.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me back. I'm honored and flattered.
Yeah.
We've been waiting for an excuse to have you back.
Were you struggling for decent guests? And now, quick, get him on the line. Get him in.
No, you're officially a friend of the show. So that's almost like being a sir. I don't know what how we refer to you now.
My initial caveat is with this list, I'm not sure that I choose it directly, Holly? I can't remember because West End Girls was in there, and any excuse to listen to that track, I'll go for it. Because interestingly, this has been a really cool thing to do, because there's a good chunk, as we will find out, of music in here that I either wasn't aware of or kind of knew but never really bothered with because they didn't hit over here. They didn't land so well. So it was quite interesting to kind of go through these songs and go, I didn't know this and it's shit, or I didn't know this and isn't it great, you know? And I've got to say, Cowpunk, what a tune. Love it.
All right, we're gonna get to that. Patience, my friend.
No, I felt like this was a strategic move for you in choosing this chunk, because you choose it for West End Girls. You get the bonus of, you know, one other of your favorite artists.
Yeah,
So, you know.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Anything in the 80s, we're going to stumble across stuff that we've got stuff to talk about. So it's been great.
We found in every 10-song chunk, there's always been one or two songs that we had completely forgot about or that our guest has never even heard before. So we're up to the top practically, and yet there are a lot of songs that we will discuss later that haven't been touched on in probably a long time. Number 20 song is not the case. This is Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go by Wham! Exclamation mark. How do you feel about Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go in the year 2021?
Do you know what? It's a funny track, isn't it? Because as a huge George Michael fan, massive George Michael fan, and obviously that bleeds into liking Wham and being, you know, a Wham fan. You know, they were kind of a novelty act in a way. I don't, you know, when they first hit the scene, I kind of felt like they were a novelty act to me. I think probably because it, I mean, certainly with a track like this, with that, you know, that retro style they went for at that time, I'm trying to think in 84, you know, if I was listening to metal clanging Depeche Mode when this came out, I was probably like, really? You know?
So how did you, so that's what you, that's your recollection of how you felt about it then?
I think so. I think, yeah, because you know, there are some great, great Wham songs. I wouldn't say this was it or one of them, but still, you've still got to kind of hold it up as a fantastic 80s tune, as one of those sort of touchstone 80s songs, I guess.
So seeing this video and, you know, two actually really good looking guys dancing around and goofing off, and, you know, was that something like, oh, okay, this is something not for me. This is something for a younger generation, perhaps? Or was it like you recognized, oh, okay, there's something here?
I think you're probably right. Maybe by the time I'm hitting 18, you know, the pop charts, and maybe it's probably still the case, it's certainly on top of the pops back in 1984, which was the, you know, the go-to Thursday night TV show where this would have popped up and we would have all watched it. Those top pop songs were all aimed at 14-year-olds, 14, 15-year-olds, weren't they? And younger. So maybe at that point I was getting more cynical.
Yeah.
You know, and listening to, and as I say, listening to kind of dark, more dark sort of, you know, industrial music, as we'll come to.
Yeah.
So, and you know, don't get me wrong. When I hear it now, I love it. And I think what George was brilliant at was their remit. Funny enough, my son bought me a book, the Andrew Ridgeley book, Wham, George and Me. And I literally only got about two pages in. And I think I recollect Andrew saying, you know, the remit was just to be unashamedly positive and poppy. That was what we went to. And, you know, the name of the band, for God's sake, you know. And I think they knew what they were doing. And George, you know, probably like Adam Ant in his time, knew exactly what he was doing from a PR point of view and from a brand perspective, you know. Now, whether they thought that hard about it, I think George probably did have, you know, when you look at how George shaped everything he did with a fine tooth comb, if that's the right phrase. You know, I think it was really, really interesting that they did that. I think, you know, probably sat and, although, you know, we'll probably find out there was the label that turned around and went, you better release that song, not that song, which seems to be the case half the time.
So you're saying you think he specifically chose the dolphin shorts for the, you know, the shorts that he was wearing in the video?
Well, and at that point, we didn't know who he was appealing to, did we? I mean, he just like, you know.
All I knew was that it was appealing to me. And that's really all that mattered when I was 19 years old.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. And that hair, I mean, you know, who's not loving that hair?
Okay. And I'm going to say something probably totally inappropriate. For the time, for the current time. So George Michael, who, you know, we all love for, you know, many reasons. Andrew Ridgeley, who was obviously an integral part of Wham, if you took George, the visual of George away, Andrew Ridgeley is cute. Girls would have gone gaga for him too.
They did.
It's just George, they yeah, did, didn't they?
Yeah.
They did, but not so much. I mean, George Michael was kind of it for,
It's like all duos. There's always, you know, there's the dream. You got your Hall and then you got your Oates. So, you know, there's always a yin and a yang.
You want to ask Dan the question about his favorite duos?
Well, there's so many duos. Do you have a favorite duo? I know, you know, there's a lot out there. What do you like?
Well, a couple of things. It's funny when I saw your question and I thought it's funny. I didn't think of Wham as a duo because you had Pepsi and Shirley in there as well. So. Yeah. On stage, there was always four of them turning up, you know. And it's funny because George then just became George, didn't he? And everything else went into the background almost, with the greatest respect to the other guys. So I never really felt like they were a duo, weirdly, but I had an idea with a friend of mine a few years back. He said, we should go out and we should form a band, just the two of us. And we'll call it like Master and Servant or something like that. And I'll just do songs by, you know, Yazoo, OMD, Pet Shop Boys, all of it. Just do duos. Just do that. Because you could probably find a massive, you could mine a massive amount of songs, Tears for Fears, you know.
I love this idea.
Of great duos. I guess if you're asking me what's the greatest duo, I don't know. It's like what's the best song? You know, it depends what mood you're in. I'm absolutely adore Tears for Fears. And funny enough, discovered a lot of his stuff, more recent stuff that I haven't really bothered to listen to over the years. And I sort of dropped back into it. And he's just done a podcast called The Rock on Tours, which is fantastic. Roland's just done that.
Oh,
and,
okay. This is Roland you're talking about?
It's great to hear him.
Not Kurt.
Roland Orzabal, yeah. You know, Roland was the kind of driving force initially in those Salad days. And you know, and Roland freely admits that for him, it was my way or the highway. And I think Kurt plainly was happy to kind of let him be him. So, yeah, you know, but then Hall & Oates, what can, you know, you've got to say that, you know, that again, there's no contest if you're talking Hall & Oates, but it's an entirely different genre.
So you get to pick one from each genre. That would be my... one from each genre. I mean, what about Pet Shop Boys?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is funny. There's always one front person and one person who kind of takes one step back, but they're still...
The George and then the Andrew.
Yeah. I mean, White Stripes, same thing. Yeah. There was always like front person and someone who's kind of in the background. We still put them on the cover. They'll still be on the cover. But I never thought of Wham as a four-piece. Because, you know, the girls were never on the cover. They were never featured at all, except in the videos. They were never official Wham members, though, right? We'll have to get Andrew in.
I think you're right.
You know, when we talk to Andrew. And why'd you only get through three pages, or did you give up after? Or...
No.
You're too busy.
One of the things I always say, my New Year's resolution is always to read more, and I never do it. And one of the things I did, and I'm going to do it, I've got a fucking stack of books. It's simply that I just haven't been. I've got back into watching box sets and Netflix and TV because I freely admit I'm a video. I love playing video games. I'm a huge video games fan, and I ended up getting my PlayStation about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. And I wiped it. I hit delete on everything. I hit, do you want to reset this PlayStation? And I said, yes, I did. It was like a death in the family. And I got it and I wiped it and I got all the controllers and I put them all in a box and they're outside my studio out here because I thought I've got to read more and I've got to get back into kind of following up. All those things when you talk to people, they say, are you watching Your Honor? Are you watching, you know, Sopranos? So I'm doing that at the moment. So the book readings go to the side, but I will read the Wham book. I really want to, because it will be interesting to hear it from Andrew's side as well. I think, you know, purely for that, it's always interesting to hear having been a sidekick myself, that's always an interesting side.
Okay, wait, can we just go back to Master and Servant for a minute? Not the song, but the duo.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So that would have been a great pandemic project. You could have developed a whole Zoom following and then taken it on the road when it's over. Seriously.
That's very true. I wanted to do it with this friend of mine called Rob, who's also a complete utter 80s electronica nut and a synth nut. And I said, I want him. He's tall. He's like 6'5" or something. And he's a statuesque dude. And I said, it'd be great. You stood at the back with a big leather coat on with your synth. And I'll be down the front grooving away like I'm still 19. I thought it would be such a cool thing to do. And you just call it Master and Servant. And you literally just, you plunder all those duos, all those synth. I mean, it could be synth duos as well, because you've got Erasure and Yazoo and all those other, you know, all the kind of Vince Clarke stuff, you know.
I'll be the friend of the stage. I'll be there you go. There's your, you know, anything else you were planning on doing after this.
All right. Trademark. There you go.
It's happening.
When we do 1985, I am going to ask you about Andrew Ridgely book. So make sure to read it. By 2022.
Sometime over the...
Because we will discuss it. Okay. Let's move on to number 19, In Excess, Original Sin. Holly has a soft spot for In Excess. What do you think about this song? How does this hold up for you?
First and foremost, have you seen the Michael Hutchence documentary? Did they play it out in the States? It was on about 3 years ago.
Yeah, I haven't seen that
Something
one yet.
Like that.
Holly, she always promises to see things and yet never gets to it. I mean, she's very busy. I know.
He just comes across as such a great bloke and a real kind of genuine guy and a real, and like all these tortured souls, somebody that needed to be held and nurtured and looked after properly. And, you know, and it's a brilliant documentary with a heartbreaking ending. Mm-hmm. But wow, did he go out with some great women? We must all get reminded of that. There's a lovely sequence of him on the Orient Express with Kylie Minogue. Fucking hell, Michael. But he was so sexy.
That's your
what
royal
sexy
couple.
Guy.
That's the Australian royal couple then.
Yeah. The last time I spoke to you guys, we'd rattled through me meeting people, which seemed to be something that I did a lot in my career. And he came on a show in 1992, 93, I think it was, called The Big Breakfast, which is where he met Paulie Yates. And we all watched them flirting outrageously on the bed during this interview. That there was a bed in this, in this house.
You shouldn't interview people out of bed.
Well, that was the whole point of it. It was always Paula on a bed with her guest. You know, from Miss Piggy to Michael Hutchence, it was anybody, and it was always in a bed. You know, because of the breakfast show thing and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And she flirted outrageously with him on that, and then obviously the rest is history with those two. Mm-hmm. But weirdly, this song didn't really hit in the UK. It didn't really make a dent. I know of it and knew of it and listened to it and went, I know that track. Kick was the album that launched them in the UK, really. Yeah. You know, with Need You Tonight, New Sensation, Never Tear Us Apart, what a song. So this was kind of one of those songs that I think was, you guys kind of, you know, found them a little bit sooner than us, I think.
Huh. Yeah, we did. Well, that's, it's because of K-Rock. Like you mentioned, it took them a couple albums before they found their way. And this was kind of a launching song for them. Yeah. Like, all right, they're starting to find their groove right about now.
You might know of the original sin. You might know how to be with fire. But did you know all the murder committed?
That's right. And Kick was like 87, wasn't it? I think so. They were in waiting for us. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we just didn't have the, I'm trying to think when MTV was doing its thing in the UK, you know, and to kind of get these bands launched and get them, you know, get them up in front of us. Interestingly, I think with a lot of these songs on this playlist as well, the sound of them is, there's an Americanness to the sound of the tracks that hit in America that when you listen to the UK stuff, we wanted it more edgy and more in your face. Because, you know, you listen to Original Sin and it's got a kind of rolling kind of groove and, it hasn't got the punch of Need You Tonight or New Sensation of those tracks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, we needed our Daryl Hall and we needed our sax solo in songs for it to be a hit.
But this was a Nile Rodgers. Nile Rodgers produced this song.
Yeah.
How cool has your life got to be that you can phone up Daryl Hall and ask him to come in and sing on a song?
Right?
Hey, Daryl, how cool is that? What a great life that is, you know?
Daryl Hall was also on the Elvis Costello song for The Only Flame in Town. Yeah. Daryl Hall is also on background vocals. He's actually in the video for that, too.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
So fun. And why wouldn't you? What a vocalist.
Right?
What a singer. Oh, just fantastic. Yeah. One of the reviews in New Musical Express, which is the UK, you know, music magazine in 84, that said, I wrote it down, it said, In Excess was described in the New Musical Express as a depressingly definitive example of excruciating, boring, incredibly unimaginative MTV rock. That's how awful the British press were about In Excess on that song.
Usually so kind and generous, the British press.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, harsh, but then, you know, I mean,
it's always black and white with them. So you always know if you get like a horrible review, like, oh, I might need to listen to this.
Yeah.
I know. But and back in the day, we had to rely on the press. You know, we couldn't, because, you know, I'm not gonna pay in 84, I don't know how an album was, 10 bucks for you know, like just to listen to a whole thing. Like, okay, all right, if it's got a bad review, I don't think I'm going to invest in this. What was your strategy when you went to a record store? Did you have a game plan, or was it or did you talk to the guy? What was how'd you discover new music?
Somebody said this, I think it was on Twitter quite recently, said, do you remember back in the day we would buy music we didn't like, because you'd buy an album knowing maybe two tracks off it or the single off it, and then you'd have another 8 or 9 songs. Yeah. You had no idea what they were going to be.
You go home and you go, what the fuck is this?
You'd have to invest 3, 4, 5 days or weeks or whatever it was of your life to try and get into it, because you didn't want to waste your money. And also, you know, if it was an artist you liked, you're going, I'm going to, you know, connect with this if it kills me.
Yeah. I'm going to like this regardless.
Yeah, I funnily enough, I don't have a massive amount of vinyl. So I plainly was, because I don't kind of remember, I bought stuff on recommendation when I was very young. I think the first song I bought was Starman by David Bowie when I was 7. But that was like, I'd heard it on the radio and my mum took me down to HMV in Putney and I handed over my money and was given this 7-inch single. And but then as far as like albums are concerned, I obviously was really conservative about it and didn't splash my cash and go crazy. I think I probably recorded more off the radio on cassette, you know? So I've got a, it's funny, but I think like anything, I think I probably knew the hit, I'm going to buy that. And if I, and I had to get the 12 inch, if the 12 inch was out, I would buy the 12 inch before I buy the 7-inch if I could, because I knew then I'd be getting, you know, an extended mix. So you're getting longer, something longer to listen to.
More for your money.
Liked. But I, yeah, did I talk to the guy or girl? I don't know. Sometimes I remember getting a Thomas Dolby album recommended to me. I went in and was talking to the guy and he said, "Have you, this has just come out." And I was like, oh, I didn't know it had come out. And he's like, yeah, you know, listen. And that was that recommendation. But I probably, like everybody, just chanced it, you know?
Dave, you probably did some very, very thorough research.
I try, yes, because, you know, you're making, you know, $3.50, $4 an hour and, you know, plus tax. So it was like 3 hours of work to afford an album. Rode my bike to the Licorice Pizza and like, and was like, I had to give it some deep, deep thought, especially when you're trying to, I was also discovering classic rock and like, oh, should I buy a catalog record or something? You know, I didn't call it catalog, or should I buy the, you know, this new record that I'm kind of excited about, or yeah. So it was tough to decide what to get, because I only can buy one or maybe two if I wanted to splurge.
Would you go in and would either of you go in and get the headphones out and ask them to, you know, put things on? You go in a booth and stuff or whatever, or get them to put something on?
I don't think they had booths where we were. They didn't have booths.
They did. Some of them started to a little bit later, but I would never ask anybody for help because I'm just not that way. But when they were totally set up, I would go in and listen. I can't remember which ones had those. If it was like,
it wasn't until CDs came out where they had the, like at Virgin Music, I remember you can, they had the, those listening booths. But yeah, it felt like you were, I don't know. You had to ask the front, the guys at the front, if they would play this record while you perused,
and be ready for them to judge your musical taste.
Right. That's the other thing.
Well, that right. You kind of counted on that.
I want to hear this album and them looking down their noses at you. You know, really?
Yeah.
And feeling validated when it was something. Ah, good choice.
Yeah.
It's
the high fidelity.
High fidelity. Are you talking about REO Speedwagon?
No, I'm talking about
listening in high fidelity.
I'm talking about, no, I'm talking about Nick Hornsby and John Cusack and.
Yeah.
Anyway,
what a tune.
Yeah. That was High Infidelity, was the REO Speedwagon. We are talking with Dan McGrath and having a great time. We're going to take a break, though. Maybe have a biscuit. Want to have a biscuit, Holly?
Maybe some tea.
Biscuit and tea. We're going to have a biscuit and tea and be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycom order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our guest, Dan McGrath.
This was in LA. We're moving on to number 18. This is a band called The Untouchables. This is actually the second song on this chart, an LA band that K-Rock liked to promote, and it's ska. The song is called What's Gone Wrong. I am almost 100% sure that you had never heard of this band or this song, but this was something that was churned out in LA. I thought it was a big hit. I think I found it in the used record section. So I do remember buying it because I like ska. I'm like, oh, okay, this might be the next thing after the Specials and, you know, Madness and things like that. But what'd you think? Were you a ska guy? What's your opinion now of this?
So the kind of two-tone era for us, in the UK, hitting sort of, was it 79? It was post-punk, and then it was like across the end of the 70s, start of the 80s, wasn't it? And there must have been a couple of years when Two Tone, the label, I had a friend that made it his remit to buy every single release by the Two Tone label for 1 year. And wow. I think he still got them somewhere.
Nice.
Yeah. Everything that came out, he bought it and had it all. There was a shop in Clapham, which was in South London, called Thrifts, and it was like dead guys' clothes. So it was old suits and old coats and stuff like that. And as you say, as students, we had no money, but you could go in there and get a two-tone suit for, like, I don't know, not much money. So me and my mate John went in there and bought two-tone suits, and you could get tonic jackets, you know, so the shimmery, you know, cloth. And then I had loafers. I had brown loafers. Never wore a pork pie hat. That was a bit too much. But yeah, Fred Perry, that kind of stuff. And I went through a rude boy stage, as they called them.
Yeah.
Interesting. The What's Gone Wrong thing, I was aware of it. I knew it. When I put it on, I was like, yeah, I remember this. But they did better with a track called Free Yourself. That was a much bigger hit in the UK. And that was 85. It got to number 26. But funnily enough, so I put on Free Yourself as well when I was listening to all these. I'll have a quick listen to Free Yourself to remind me. And it sounds like a demo. It's so funny compared to the production quality of even into the later 80s and 90s. But like, if you listen to it compared to modern music, it sounds like they've just thrown this demo together to get to 26 with a demo. Not bad. And they had I Spy for the FBI, which was another kind of slight hit for them here. But what's gone wrong didn't really happen, I think. It was, like you say, 84. So it was like, I Free Yourself. And I think I taped it off the radio because I thought I had the vinyl of Free Yourself, but I couldn't find it. So I must have taped it off the radio. But I absolutely, when I saw the Untouchables come up on the list, I was like, oh yeah, I remember them. Oh,
that's wow.
Not for that track. And I wrote his Soft Scar. Again, I think, you know, it was very post, when the Scar thing hit in the UK, it was that fast post-punk special selector, the beat, and all the tracks were a insane speed, and you know, that brilliant jumped up, hyped up reggae ska sound, you know. Whether that's why we didn't like What's Gone Wrong, I don't know, or maybe it was just a timing thing, maybe because they're an LA band, they were doing better promotion out there.
I read this when I was looking at it because I didn't even remember the song until I listened to it, but that they were the house band at the Roxy in 1982. Did you see that, Dave?
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
I didn't remember that either.
That's funny. But you did touch upon something, like, you know, where we're deciding what to buy. Record labels were a huge influence. Yeah. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is on this label. This is on that label. Like in LA, like the label Slash. I like if a band was on there or SST, like, okay, this might be worth looking into. and of course the same with Two Tone, like, oh, okay, this is going to be good stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. We had things like Stiff and Mute, cause you know, Depeche Mode were on Mute. So I was always looking, oh, well, it's a Mute act. You know, I'd be interested because if Daniel Miller likes them, then I'm probably going to like them. Yeah. So you're right. Actually, they're like stables, weren't they? They were like, you liked what came out of that stable. You know, I was right. I'd put here that, by 84, it was only probably Madness that had survived by that point for us from that kind of era, you know, because the Specials, the Beat Selector, they were all kind of done from a pop point of view. Mm-hmm. Whereas Madness were different because Madness, although they launched on the back of that world of reggae, ska, the songwriting was much more sophisticated and, you know, they were much more of a chameleon act. They changed and you know,
crossed over
in their own way.
They also have a book out, Madness, that maybe you could put that on your list of
not another one.
Yeah, I know, no more. Let's keep moving. All right, we got Susie and the Banshees, Dazzle. Now this starts off like such an epic song, like something exciting is going to happen. You know, you add your strings and just kind of mystery to it, and then Susie kicks in. I am dazzled by this song still to this day. I think I played it. I played this a number of times in the past couple of weeks, just because I was reminded of how wonderful it is. Do you feel the same way?
It's so evocative, isn't it? It's got so much kind of it. I mean, it's when you hear Florence and the Machine, you go, okay, that's where they
100%. Yeah, I thought the same thing. Yeah.
You know,
that's a great comparison.
The stars that shine and the stars that shine in the face of stagnation, the water runs before your eyes.
And even like the Elbow track, One Day Like This, you know, those sort of big strings, it's like that was, you know, it was that wonderful epic sound at the start of that. But the other thing I thought was interesting was the actual production of it. Again, when you listen to these songs up against modern production, they're, you know, they're probably looking for that kind of wall of sound when they did it. Mm-hmm. I think I wrote down, Mike Hedges produced it, who was like, he produced The Cure and Bauhaus and U2 and Manics later on. But the sound of thought, it's funny when you listen to it, there's no definition to it. It's such this kind of watery sound that maybe that's what they wanted. They wanted that ethereal feel to it or something.
That's a really good description, actually, because I couldn't also, it's sound, but it's musical. You know, I wouldn't even know how to describe it. That's good.
This was also co-written by Robert Smith of The Cure. Which we always have to say, Robert Smith of The Cure.
Because you wouldn't know who it was if you didn't mention the band that he's associated with.
Yeah, always.
So where is she now, you asked?
I honestly don't know. I was looking. I mean, she did this one-off for the Hannibal soundtrack in 2015. The last time she played was at the Meltdown Fest around that same time, 2013. So I think she's just, I don't know, just enjoying life and, you know. Why not? More power to her. She hasn't been inspired. Did you watch it? Have you seen Hannibal? Did you ever watch that TV show? I know you don't watch TV shows. You're not a TV guy.
I'm trying to be.
The showrunner for this show was a huge Susie fan. And he just happened to approach, I guess he knew someone who knew someone. Like, can you get Susie to do this? And it turns out she was a huge fan of this show. And she's like, all right, yeah, sure, we'll try it.
The skies tumbling from your eyes, so sublime, a chase to end our time. Seasons call and fall from.
So, I mean, she's just got to get inspired. You got to inspire her. Give her a project to, you know, maybe it's part of, maybe part of Master and Servant or something. Maybe she can do something. All right. So come back, Susie. We need you. The world needs you. Let's move on to number 16. This band, Depeche Mode. I don't know. This is the aforementioned Master and Servant. Depeche Mode. Were you full on at this time? Like, this is, I'm all in on Depeche Mode, or did it take some more convincing?
I mean, I was all in from Speak and Spell, so I was buying everything and anything they did. I know you put in your, it's a lot, let's just move on. I'm guessing, because it's interesting listening to these tracks, the two Depeche Mode tracks that are in this list, because the sound of them, which was driven by Alan Wilder, the thing you can't, we've got to never underestimate is what Alan Wilder did for that band during his time with it. All those samples and all those sounds and all that kind of sound design, was a lot of it was him. And actually, when you listen back, it's funny, real mixed emotions about it, because I remember at the time really loving listening to what they were putting out, and friends were listening to stuff like Daff and some of those other mad kind of metal clanging angle grinder on stage, Einar Steiner Neuser, German named long, you know, new artist. And this was the kind of pop version of that. This was all nicely put into 3 minutes for pop audiences, wasn't it? But is it their best output? No, I don't think so. I think they're great, these tracks, and I love them because they evoke and all this, like anything, you know, you can listen to what is potentially a really awful, tragic piece of production or music, but it doesn't matter because at the time you were in your salad days and it meant something.
It's a lot.
Reality, you cheat. with this as well, you know, some of the kind of awful vocals and sounds and stuff, you go, you know, if this was put out now, people would go, the fuck is that song? Wouldn't they? It's a lot. You know, it's like, what are they doing? They're trying to sound like fucking Queen.
You make it sound like Queen. Yeah. I guess.
It was like a salad. They're just throwing everything in. Here, I've got an idea. Great. Throw it in. Here's another. What if we do this? What if we put this little weird sound in? Great. Throw it in there. Okay. Let's mix it up and see what we got.
Yeah. And also, don't forget, we were in an era in 84, sampling synthesizers were now becoming available to everybody and anybody, because a lot of this stuff was done on, I think it was on like the emulator and the Emacs, a company called Emu, I think it was an Australian synth company, were creating synth samplers that people could afford. I think I'm getting this right, because prior to that, you had kind of Trevor Horn and people who had lots of money buying the Fairlight, but this stuff was a bit more, you could lift it onto a stage and tour with it. So that, as you rightly say, Dave, they were obviously throwing things at walls and recording it and putting it into the synth and playing it back in the same way that we will hear when we get to one of the other tracks on here. the next one, the amount of sampling and the amount of re-triggered samples in the track is beyond belief.
Let's move on to number 15. This was also kind of a remix song in us. The Eurythmics were also experimenting, and this was this song, Sex Crime, 1984. They were also doing a lot of different things in this and kind of doing some studio tricks that were state of the art in 1984. I don't know if it holds up or, you know, like some of this stuff, you know, the robotic voice and repeating, you know, of vocals over and over and over.
crime.
Right. Yeah. What was the guy's
dated?
What was Max Headroom? That type of that type of thing. Yeah.
I mean, that's not this. That was like kitschy. This is just, you know, a product of the times.
Yes, of course. It's Eurythmic, so it's wonderful. But production wise, I don't know how well it's aged.
I think you're right. I think it's dated it terribly with the amount of key hitting. They've obviously, as you say, gone, this is really cool, isn't it? You know, and kept on doing it. And of course, don't forget, he's got a vocoder in there as well, which, although the vocoders have been around for ages, because ELO had, you know, Jeff Lynne was using vocoders on those albums, you know, all that 1984, he was throwing the kitchen sink at it, didn't he, as far as tech toys.
It sounds futuristic when you say it, right? When you say it in the vocoder.
It sounds future, and that again, that might have been part of the whole notion of it, because it was to do with the movie, and you know, so they obviously said, "Well, let's try and make it sound futuristic." And what is futuristic? Well, sampling it. So they must have had one eye on the fact that it was overkill for that reason, that it needed to sound synthetic and edgy or whatever.
Crime.
Of course, what you get with these, the same with like Yazoo or Yaz as they were called in America, you've got the clinical tech with the brilliant soulful voice. So, you know, Alison Moyet's voice over the top of Vince Clarke's phenomenally quantized electronics. And it's same with Erasure. But then again with his, I mean, Annie, what a voice she has. So Dave could do all that technology underneath her and it still sounded brilliantly, well, you know, it sounded like rock music. Yeah. She had such a great voice.
And Holly is a huge Eurythmic fan. What do you think?
You know, I hadn't listened to the song. I didn't even remember the song until, you know, coming upon it in this. I loved this song at the time and I love her, but everything about them was, you know, you're just transfixed watching her, you know? And since you're attaching the video, I'm always watching the video with the song, not just listening for the song. So seeing her and just, she can do no wrong. Yes, I like the song. And this song, it actually, even with the dated, all the things you're talking about, to me, it's, I don't know if I can say it stood the test of time, but it was fun to listen to again.
It was released as a single, but it only made it up to number 81 in the US. I don't know how well it did in the UK, but this was not a big hit.
It went higher. I think it was better. Number 4 in the UK.
Yeah, it did pretty well.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, they were flying in 84, I would have thought so.
Their next single would be Would I Lie to You? So, you know, Eurythmics had still a lot more to offer. this was kind of a challenge to them. Have you scored for movies? You know, like doing a Susie, like Susie did for Hannibal and Eurythmics did for 1984. Have you done something like this?
I'd love to be in the position like Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, where they took the Social Network and did that lovely ambient electronic weird kind of, you know, when you think about that theme, that music with the social, it was called the Social Network, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it would work, but it worked brilliantly because it was about a tech company, obviously, but it was so dark and weird. And you think, well, it's about Facebook, you know, but it works so beautifully. But also I think just from a sonic point of view, I can't sit and score to picture. It's not, I don't have the ability. I don't have the chops. But to kind of maybe get asked to do something that's more ambient and more kind of, you know, otherworldly, yeah, it'd be great.
Put yourself out there more, you know?
Put away the game console.
Yeah, I know. Come on, man.
Too much stuff to watch on the telly. That's scored by better people than I.
Number 14, The Fix, Less Cities, More Moving People. The Fix were huge in 1984. And this was a song that obviously did really well on K-Rock, making it all the way up into the top 20. What do we think of this song?
I'm guessing The Fix were not as big. They were a band not as big in the UK at all.
Yeah, I was aware of them. So when it came up, I thought, yeah, I know the name. But were they American? They weren't Australian, were they? Were they from the States?
That's funny, because I always confused NXS and The Fix.
I
didn't know who was who. No, they were... In 1984, I had a hard time distinguishing which one was this an NXS song? Is this a Fix song? So, yeah. But that's just me.
I was trying to kind of, they felt to me like one of those bands like Bush or Wang Chung that made it huge in America, but did nothing in the UK. Were the Fix? No, they were British, weren't they? That's why I think I wrote that down. And they, you know, they obviously nailed that sound that you guys loved and we just didn't go for it. So I was trying to think, like Wang Chung, you know, they just did nothing over here, but Dance All Days and all these other couple of songs, you know, they hit in the States. I wrote here, you don't hear a train beat in the charts much these days. It's always nice to hear a train beat, which is like that rolling beat that track has. It's a nice song, but, again, it's funny. I had no recollection of it.
Another home falls by the wayside. A few old cushions stuffed with pride. A hand is shaking from the rubble. This is spirit still alive. A servant bears his occupation. Breaks his back just growing old.
And Holly, in my notes, I made mention that it kind of reminded me of Rush's Subdivision. What do you think?
I would never have made that connection myself. Yes, I can see how you would say it. But this song I actually like better than, you know, their bigger hits. Yeah, it does have a Subdivisions vibe to it.
It's a good hook. I thought the chorus was great. You know, when I started listening to it, yeah, it was a really great hook to listen to.
Yeah, again, this was not a single. K-Rock picked it up and it was played.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was kind of cool.
He had a decent mullet too, Cy Kernan, by the way.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, good. No, yeah. That's all right.
Oh, good. And he was in the Better Be Good to Me video, right? With Tina Turner? Yeah. He looked a lot like Billy Zabka, circa Karate Kid in the mid-80s. Yeah. He had that foamed hair. I don't know. He had that hair going on.
Molded hair.
Yeah, that's it. It's a good look. It works. Worked in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The mullet is, the mullet makes, seems to every now and then make a bit of a resurgence, doesn't it? When somebody, like we had it recently with Joe Exotic on the Tiger King.
How do you know about Joe? You said you weren't watching TV and yet you know Joe Exotic.
No, everybody watched the Tiger King on the first lockdown, didn't they? We all watched that.
Yes, I was shamed into it.
Yeah, it was horrendous and brilliant at the same time, wasn't it? But one of the kids I work with, had this peroxide kind of mullet. And he said, I'm really annoyed because I had this before Joe Exotic and now everybody thinks I've just done my hair for that reason. But the mullet kind of comes and goes, doesn't it? You know, you had the, obviously in the 80s, and then a little bit of Billy Ray Cyrus and stuff. And every now and then somebody will try and re-nail it.
It's going to.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Like it you
always,
talk about,
always works.
No, making a resurgence of with the
business up front and party round the back.
That's right.
Yeah.
What's your neck warmer? What do you call it? A neck warmer? It had a lot of different.
Awful hairstyle.
I was a fan at the time. I was a big fan at the time.
Oh, sure. She married a guy had one of those looks.
Well, and there were some good ones. Nick Kershaw, he had a great mullet. That was a quality mullet, I think. You know, some people did nail a good 80s mullet. Well, and, you know, of course, Bono.
Simon Le Bon and Andy. Great mullets at the time.
Yeah.
At the time.
I'm not going to be heading up the Bring Back the Mullet campaign.
All right.
Did King make it into the U.S. at all? Did they hit with Love and Pride?
Yeah, that was a song.
Yes.
Soul on My Boots. Yeah, Paul King had a great mullet.
That was a good one. All
right. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
Had its time.
Well, I'm going to post our favorite mullets.
Okay. Our favorite
collage of our favorite mullets.
Oh, I can't wait. You, as long as you put in your wedding photo in there, that's fine.
I have better. I have even our engagement photo is an even better mullet. It's more feathery.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Three more. Here we go. All right. So here we go with we're talking one hit wonders. This is someone who, I mean, just in LA, I don't think this song even made a dent anywhere else. This is Scott Goddard. The song is Cowpunk. Yeah, it's still fun. You know, this is kind of why we do this. We discover these songs that we completely forgot about. And yet I kind of still like it. It's still kind of catchy and danceable and silly. That's what I want in pop music, right?
Did you listen to it, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I put the playlist together and then let it roll around while I was like doing circuits and riding and things like that, just, you know, within the house. Really nice way of catching up with these things. And funnily enough, the whole notion of doing Master and Servant, the duo band, obviously there's I'm sure there are bands that do it. They just only do one hit wonders. And if there isn't bands only doing one hit wonders, there should be. That's a great night out because every one hit wonder was a hit.
Right.
And you go, oh, this one, you know, M pop music or whatever it might be, you know.
Yeah.
I really like this. I think it's great, you know, because it's totally kind of goofy and off the wall and kind of has a great post-punk sound to it, even though it was 84 by, you know. I would have possibly passed it by if it hadn't had that brilliant sort of Newman style synth.
Yep.
It's like a kind of Gary Newman. It sounds like a sort of mix. Did the Resident? There was a track by the Residents called 17. Did that? That was like a post-punk track that it probably only hit in the UK. And it had a kind of B-52 sound to it, didn't it? And it was like that sort of not really my thing. But then when he mixed this weird, the guitars with the synths, I was like, this is great. I think it's cool. Yeah, it was cool. She drives a new Thunderbird, owns a stack of credit cards. Yeah, she parties real cool. She parties real hard. I've been to Bakersfield twice and four county fairs, but I never seen a woman like that anywhere. Oh, those nights in Fillmore. Who could ask for anything more? Saw you dancing in the heat. You threw my love right out of the street.
mean, who is Scott Goddard? What do we know about him?
Dave, did you know he was in the Surf Punks?
I didn't do any further research on it. So, okay.
Yeah, I had no idea. Here's so Surf just Punks is an LA band that
I had no idea. The Surf Punks are another LA band. They did like a songs called like My Beach, Get Off. It was just kind of like, you know, they were goofy fun. So that kind of makes sense that, that he would do like a little country twinge punk song. Yeah. It's fun. It's fun. And yeah, it makes perfect sense that K-Rock would adapt this song as their own and put it so high on their 1984 charts.
The album was called 110 Billion. And in my notes, I just saw it when I was making notes. I said, Gary Numan, same thing. It sounds like the intro. I made the same.
Yeah, that kind of wailing synth sound.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gave it that kind of post-punk electronic sound to it.
Yeah. Cow
what
punk.
Is he doing now? That's the other thing. That's another series, isn't it? Where all these people are at the moment. Where yeah.
He died.
Did he?
Yeah.
Way to bring us down, Dan.
Well, he left a legacy.
But his name lives on. Here we go. That's why we're doing this.
We love him for it. Bless you, Scott.
All right. Let's move on to better things now. Okay. So it's Depeche Mode again. People are people, aren't they? I mean, come on. You can't argue with that. That's a statement that just stands the test of time. People are people. That's how I explain anything. Why is this going on in the world? Well, you know, people are people. All right.
It's like saying it is what it is.
It's kind of exactly same idea.
We're talking about, you know, people getting back out of their houses after the lockdowns and just throwing their rubbish everywhere. And this is it. People are people. And why should it be?
Yeah.
We have to talk about the lyric, you and I should get along so awfully, because when they all sat around on the sofas at the back of the studio writing this song, and Martin gets the guitar out and says, you and I should get along so awfully. Did no one turn around and go, no, that's a terrible lyric.
You know what? But it sticks in your mind. And so it works. Apparently, you know, lyrics don't need to. They don't need to make sense. Words were made up.
What are words for?
Right, exactly. What was it? The Steve Miller song, The Pompatus of Love? There's no such thing as The Pompatus. What is, you know?
There's a guy called Danny Baker, who's a radio host. He did a phone-in of lyrics that didn't make sense. Oh. And you know the song Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy?
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
So tonight there's going to be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. You kind of figure it's probably at the jail. Like that's. I don't know. You know, just work that one out. You know,
and see, you just say the words and you don't think about it. But of course, there's always someone who's like, "Wait a second, let's back this up."
Yeah, I will accept any lyric you throw at me.
What was that? Yeah, there was a horse with no name. For there ain't no one for to give me no pain or something like that. Like what? That's not a sentence. What is that?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's got to fit quickly so you can get on. You don't want to stop the creative muse.
The whole
you?
Thing, yeah. The hot was heat, wasn't it? That was also in that song. That's just off the top things that I still remember. But
yeah.
It's just crazy. All right, so Depeche Mode albums. What do you have a favorite? As long as we're talking Depeche Mode, I'm now that I've talked to you, I have a feeling like those earlier ones are the ones that stick the most, stick the landing for you.
I tried to have a think about this for you. Obviously, I wrote down, is it one of my top five favorite Depeche Mode songs? People. No, I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. And I wrote down here my top five. Possibly, if I had to commit, it would be Dreaming of Me.
Okay.
But because, I mean, that song just, every time I hear it, it just takes me right back to when I first heard all that stuff and was like, you know, loving it. Somebody, which, did we mention Somebody? Somebody's just a great song. Another Martin Gore sort of slushy one. Never Let Me Down, because if you ever go and see Depeche Mode live, when they do Never Let Me Down, the place goes absolutely crazy with everybody waving their arms. And it's a really great step. It was one of those songs that Depeche Mode became a stadium band and people went, oh, they aren't just this sort of synth pop band. They're
They can fill stadiums and people react to these big sounds, you know. Personal Jesus has to be in there because it's just a brilliant track and a, you know, and we love that shuffle stomp, you know, if you're writing a song and you go for that meter, it's great, but it is a brilliant song as well. And of course, Johnny Cash did his version of it. And then, and World in My Eyes, because you mentioned Violator possibly in the top albums. And as an opening track, it's great. It's really, because I quickly put it on. And if you listen to World in My Eyes as an opening track of an album, it's very, what's the word? I'm trying to think what it is. It's very, they're just putting it out there. I'm trying to think what the word is. It's not bombastic. It's one of those things like, here you go, fucking have this track. Here it is. It's the opening track of an album. I've got the world in my eyes. And it's just like, it's so positive. And it's so like, we know what we're doing here.
I'm here.
You know, there's an element. Yeah. And them kind of going, here you go. Here's track one. Enjoy this, you know? So yeah, people, again, we go back to the whole thing of it was that kind of metal clanging sampling era. And they're quite trashy, those tracks, but still, again, some great reward, got some great tracks on it, Blasphemous Rumours and things. It's such a good album, but probably not my top five. And then if we're going to get into albums, I think, yeah, Violator's got to be up there because and two brilliant radio songs, Personal Jesus and Enjoy the Silence, both songs that radio playlists will always welcome and put on, you know, when they just sound great coming out the radio, don't they? And then Music for the Masses, got to be a great album. That's a great album, produced by Dave Bascom, who obviously did Tears for Fears as well. So you've got Never Let Me Down, and you've got that big set. You've got them starting to fill stadiums and sound, you know. I think that whole notion, Dave Garn obviously went through all his dark period because he really struggled with being in Depeche Mode and being associated with a teen synth band. And so, yeah, Music for the Masses. And I think they said, you know, they were taking the piss with the title, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know, even putting the speakers on the front to sort of go, this is, you know, this is broadcast everybody. And also Music for Mass has got I Want You Now on, which is a brilliant track. Great track. I love that.
All right. Song number 11, which is horribly misplaced. I don't know why it's at 11. It should be at number one. This is West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys. I don't understand. The greatest song of all time. I mean, it's to me, it still holds up well. But go ahead, touch on, Dan, what this means to you and why this is why we're talking today. I guess is because you chose this song.
I love that you mentioned Cardi B. Cardi B tweeted.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right.
Cardi B tweeted. What? How come the Pet Shop Boys are so underestimated? And I'm like, underestimated? You're fucking joking, aren't you? You know.
Well, being 20, however old, 30.
Yeah. I mean, for her kind of age group, that's you can say that because other people that don't know them will go, oh really? You know.
Yeah.
For me, this song, there's so much to it that is right about it. And funny enough, I started trying to work out how to play it. I got the synth and the bass line up on my keyboard in the studio because that opening chord, when you hear that opening pad, and also they've used real sounds in there. They've used the footsteps and stuff, the street sounds. I'm a massive fan of that. I love Thomas Dolby because he does a lot of that in all his songs. He'll throw in real sounds and stuff in that just take you there. Also being a Londoner as well. So, you know, there's all that going on. But when you hear that opening synth, it's like, and I was just saying, you can taste it again. You can smell and taste the moment you were listening to that song when you were listening to it in 1984. And it's just brilliant. And it's just got that an air to it. I mean, it is one of the most definitive 80s songs, David. As you say, it should be at number one.
In town, a dead end world.
And the Pet Shop Boys, it's funny because kind of, you know, done some really weird stuff that's trashy and ridiculous and pompous and everything. And they use a lot of sevenths in it, the chords of minor sevenths and stuff, which have that lovely kind of smile. There's a pathos, but there's a smile to those chords. They're great pop chords as well, you know. People like Greg Alexander, who was in the New Radicals, you know, all his songs that he wrote, all big major sevens, because and the Beatles loved a seventh. You know, it's just got a sound to it. And as soon as you hear that opening pad, I'm like, oh, fuck yeah, this is just one of the best songs ever. And the production's brilliant as well. Stephen Hague produced it, didn't he? Who was like New Order and Erasure and stuff like that. And apparently there's a version that I haven't heard that was prior to this that they'd done and it had failed. And I haven't heard that. So it'd be worth us try to dig that out and find it.
The finest song by a duo, possibly. Could this be better than any Hall & Oates song or Simon & Garfunkel? What do you think? If you were going to list your top 10, your three favorite duo songs, this would be in there, right?
Yeah. I think so. I think, and also because Neil Tennant's vocals, you know, he's not the greatest singer in the world. He's got that sound to him. Yeah, he was an editor of Smash Hits back in the day, which was, you know, one of the teen pop magazines. So he had a kind of grounding in pop as well. So they knew how to make these things, I guess. So he had a good idea of how to make them work with Chris Lowe. But yeah, even the vocal, the spoken vocal, a rap, I guess back in the day, you know, we were hearing different people trying to rap and some people nailed it and some people really didn't nail talking on record.
Wasn't this song went to number one here, didn't it?
It was number one for a week in the US.
a week.
And actually it in 1986, which is interesting.
The reason they named the album Please. So that fans could go into the record store and say, may I have the new Pet Shop Boys album, please?
All their albums have all got one word, haven't they? Yeah. Is that why they did that?
That's interesting. So yeah, while we go into record shops, we go back to the record shop. Again, we're talking duos and record shops. That's the theme of this episode.
Yeah. What is it about duos? The master and servant thing is going to have to happen, isn't it?
100%. Oh, yes. Well, thanks for working with us. This was a lot of fun.
It's been lovely to see you. It's been great to see you.
It's so nice to see you. Thank you for doing this.
Maybe we'll do it face-to-face in the autumn if anything comes about. Who knows?
I'm counting on it.
Okay, so that was the penultimate episode. We are counting down the songs 20 to 11 on this episode. But this one was really cool, especially to hear the passion that Dan has for a lot of these songs.
I love having Dan as a guest. He needs to be a much more regular guest. He has so much to contribute. He's knowledgeable about the music. He's passionate about the music. And it's just always fun to talk to him. And he always has great stories for us, something we didn't know.
And I'm sure he could talk about Depeche Mode on and on and on. So we finally had to cut him off. But it's always good because, yeah, I don't think I think he was the perfect guest for this week. We enjoyed it. You enjoy this episode. Where can they find us so they could hear more episodes of us? So they can hear more What Difference Does It Make nonsense.
You can find us on every podcast platform. You can check out our website at wddimpodcast.com. You can find us on social media at wddimpodcast. And check out our YouTube channel and subscribe. We're putting lots of behind-the-scenes stuff, outtakes, on there. Just search for our YouTube channel, What Difference Does It Make Podcast.
You can also our website, wddimpodcast.com. sign up for our newsletter. And don't forget, we are a proud member of the Pantheon podcast family. So check out some of their wonderful podcasts besides ours that are worth checking out as well. So until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.